On Wednesday, the 13th of March, Boho Cafe in Awapuni played host to a local history talk as part of Local Heritage Month here in Palmerston North. The talk was entitled A History of Awapuni Hospital and was given by Dr. Fred Hurst. Manawatū People's Radio was on hand to provide audio and also to record the event. Here is our recording of that talk.
Good afternoon. Kia ora and welcome. Thank you. The buzz of conversation is really amazing. My name is David Chappell, and I'm one of the small group who have organised these functions. It's the third of a series that we've had about the Awapuni Hospital. The first one related to the building itself. The second one related to the use it has now, and some of you might remember a nice walk we had going around the marae. And today we're going to hear something of the heart of the building from Fred Hurst, who's going to tell us about not only the building, but the people in it and what work it's done. So before we start, just a few thanks for the afternoon. We need to thank Manawatū People's Radio, without whom I wouldn't be able to be standing here and having the voice transmitted. Particularly the library heritage team. And Laura, who you can hear there. Particularly Laura, who's done so much work getting this organised. Awapuni Rotary, who are our sort of holding group sponsor. Boho, who are our hosts this afternoon. And I don't know if Margaret Campbell is here, but would need to say thank you to her because she was the one who walked many miles delivering brochures and pamphlets into people's letterboxes. So thank you, Margaret, for doing that. Oh, you are here. I couldn't see you. Thank you. That was great. Right, so today we're really fortunate to have a talk from Fred Hurst, who was the person who oversaw the work in the hospital. Fred hails from the United Kingdom, having been born in Blackpool. He came to New Zealand in 1974 as registrar at Wellington Hospital. He was then a GP at Paraparaumu for a number of years, and then coming to Mid-Central Health, where he was the clinical director of services for the elderly for 9 years. He has been on the board of the hospice, which was particularly nice for me, having a special place in my heart. The hospital opened in 1915. And closed in 1989. Today we're going to hear something not only of the building, but the influence of the work that was done there. And by flicking through some of the slides that you're going to see, it's really fascinating. So thank you, Fred, for coming and sharing with us this afternoon. And we're really looking forward to hearing what you've got to say.
Thank you very much, all of you, come this afternoon. There are many friends and colleagues here. Sorry. And I appreciate you coming to support this, and I hope I'll be able to give you new information on the progression of specialist hospital services for the elderly and how they came about. I certainly would like to acknowledge the help of the heritage staff at the library who've assisted greatly in retrieving information from the early 1900s with the commencement of the hospital. I think we're indebted to Ellen Wood, who was the former mayoress and wife of MP Michael Wood. She was obviously a real force to be reckoned with. She did a lot of fundraising for the hospital, the main hospital itself, and she was concerned about the itinerant men, primarily men, who were in the city centre. And she started fundraising with various events and subscriptions for an old men's home. Now, I wasn't aware, but old men's homes were about run essentially by hospital boards around the country. They were not for old men exclusively, but at that time, 80% of the occupants of residential care and long stay wards, the so-called chronics, were men. And they were men often, as far as the city centre was concerned, they were men who were, I suppose, outcasts from their families. They didn't have family connections. They were the so-called characters that we see about, who certainly found it very difficult to be part of the community. And for them then to be placed as they were in the new Awapuni old people's home was a major constraint for them, because they were people who didn't fit in. And to suddenly be faced with rules and regulations, lack of access to alcohol, because alcohol was a major cause of their dysfunction, if you like. So Ellen Wood was fundraising, and that was in 1906. I think it was probably fairly slow until, sadly, in May 1910, the local coroner reported the death of an old former soldier with his body found in distressing, rat-infested conditions. And he was so distressed by that, he reported to the board and said, something must be done. And the public were significantly outraged, and the board responded by saying, yes, we'll plan here in Awapuni an old people's home. And that opened in February 1915, although the official opening was April. Rural locations of these homes was purposeful. They were provided by charities and hospital boards with land often alongside. And the board, as you will see, they purchased 20 acres of land alongside with the idea... Am I standing on something? With the idea that the land could be cultivated by the so-called inmates. And so... They were excluded from the town and also from any visitors. So they were quite isolated. The intention was for them to become productive people and to work on the land next door, and that was the case also in Britain as well as here. It didn't work out very well. They had a herd of cattle, dairy cattle. They had pigs, and they had tons of veggies, with the idea that the hospital would become self-sufficient in milk. And I haven't found any evidence that, in fact, they were self-sufficient, because these were men, of course, who didn't particularly want to work, and they found it very difficult to find work where they were competing for younger people. The unions were strong, they set wage limits, and the employers didn't want to pay the wages to older blokes who weren't as efficient as the young ones. So the older blokes were just sort of put on one side. So this was, so the hospital opened, or the official opening was in April, and further additions were made. I'm okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. So You just turned it off. Yeah. So, the home opened with 55 beds, with inmates, with a ward for each sex. A farm was purchased later and extended with the animals that I've put in there. And then with the passage of time, it was named Awapuni Home. Two more wards were added, plus an admin block. And later on, the inmates seemed to be divided into those people who had higher level of care, the hospital level care, and the home. So Awapuni Hospital was so named in 1945, and then it seemed to be fairly peaceful as far as the press were concerned until 1972, when the building was deemed to be an earthquake risk. So 1976, the Hospital Board and the Department of Health agreed they would build a new hospital, and they chose Summerhill Drive. So in 1978, 120 acres were purchased at a cowtery, and it was planned to have a hospital of 202 beds. And as you can see, they were the people who were unwanted, if you like, in the main hospital. So the elderly patients, psychogeriatric patients, and general psychiatry, adolescents, physically disabled, for medium and long-term care. So when I came, there were 126 beds and 123 patients. So I want to take you back to the origins of this way of thinking. The English Poor Laws, 1600, they had a tolerant belief as far as older people were concerned who find themselves in poverty. And they believed that paupers were the victims of their own situation, and it was our Christian duty to support them and care for them. So the destitute poor became the responsibility of the local parishes to find housing for them. And workhouses were starting to be built, but they were voluntary around Britain and Wales. Almshouses built by religious and charitable bodies also started. They started, in fact, in 900 AD. But it was really from 1600 they got going. And then asylums for mentally ill people and those with dementia were starting to be built, paupers, lunatics, and the mentally ill. And in 1845, it was compulsory to have asylums throughout the whole country. So the new poor law came in 1835, and there was a whole change of attitude. Suddenly, these people were work-shy, idle, and their situation was their own fault. So workhouses were built in all areas, but essentially, they were deliberately designed to be harsh. So they were not a comfortable environment at all. And they were purposely built that way for people to be very reluctant to see it as their last refuge. Families and sexes were segregated, and people were means tested. So virtually, if you had any means, you couldn't go in. They were places of confinement here for the unwanted, always built on the edge of town. We don't want the locals seeing these people. And also, I mean, the benefit of lack of access to alcohol and in the center where they would be seen. They were certainly out of sight and out of mind. That was the intention. able-bodied inmates were required to work for their keep and very squalid conditions. And because they were compulsory to be established across the country, in order to staff them and to fund the building, often parishes grouped together as unions. And I'll show you quite a number of these union-built places. So they did it in order for it to be viable. So I'm giving this example on purpose. So Brentford is on the west side of London. They had an infirmary block built in 1900, but generally they had no nursing, no surgical facilities. There was nothing. It was bare boards, virtually. So they had also cemeteries within the building. So once people went in, they didn't come out. And they were a lost group of people because relatives tended not to go and see them because they were difficult to access. So what happened with this example, West Middlesex County Hospital, is that suddenly, 1935, they went from 160 inmates to saying, right, we're going to annex you, you're going to look after all these people, 874 people, suddenly descended on the staff of this hospital. So you either tear your hair out or you make it an opportunity. We are all very grateful that one lady took the opportunity. This was sort of an idea of the plan of how they were. So you had male, female areas, workshops, laundry, and a cemetery as well. They were all pretty well in this style. So what was the environment? So as described here, we've got everybody from unmarried mothers with infants, those with dementia, restless, noisy people, those with mental health issues, people who were bedbound, never got out of bed, and other people who were wandering about. So they were wards devoid of signs of comfort or interest. There was no effort at classifying people to group them in other areas of like need, and no diagnostic or treatment was available. They had no medications. Nobody bothered to try and diagnose their problems. They were there until they died. So investigations and treatment were not there. Independence and mobility were not encouraged. So these are the sort of people who for many years, and in fact, when really up until the 50s and 60s, people were in a dressing gown, if they were lucky, sitting out of bed, or otherwise they spent their days in bed. There was no intention to mobilize, encourage independence. So the majority of people in this hospital with those declined admission to general wards, they were chronically bedridden and labelled incurable. So little interest was shown by the medical profession in general, no teaching of care to medical students. They were never seen. So they were overcrowded, poor layout, poor lighting, very dull environment, and low black iron beds, very difficult to get in and out of bed from, poor equipment, no trained nurses, no belongings, no flowers, nothing. A very depressing environment. Along comes our saviour and my hero. So Marjorie Warren was one of five daughters. She went to the Royal Free Hospital School of Medicine for Women, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute. So she was appointed as the assistant medical officer. She had no higher specialist qualification. but her vision was tremendous. So she then became the deputy superintendent, and then the Poor Law Infirmary gave her 874 patients. So these people have gone from inmates to patients. And what she did, she developed what we now appreciate is that was the first specialist geriatric inpatient service. So, and I'll tell you what she did. She was a founder member of the British Geriatric Society, as it became. And when the National Health Service came about in 1948, she was appointed a specialist because of the skills and revolution that she revealed. So she was appointed as a specialist. And from 1940 onwards, she wrote what she did. Nobody wrote what they did. She did. And this became the Bible of how to look after elderly people in a respectful way, maximizing their independence and potential. So she wrote on developing multidisciplinary, or now called interdisciplinary, teams, and of which the nurses, the doctors, the physios, the OTs, speech therapists, pharmacists, all part of the same team working for the benefit of individual patients and talking about it. What should we do? She also described stroke and amputee rehab. So a real pioneer. So what did she do? She brought in suitable armchairs so that people could stand up using their own power, pushing up with their arms, walking aids, rehab equipment, prosthetics, the beginning of prosthetics, orthotics, podiatry, for these neglected, forgotten patients that nobody wanted to see again. She repainted all the walls. She took down walls. She put handrails, partitions, bright, attractive colors for curtains and blankets. And as the numbers went down, she increased the space around the beds to use in a functional way so that people could become mobile about the ward. So this is Marjorie Warren working with two hemiplegic patients that had strokes, herself going up and down the stairs with them. Now, there may be some older nurses and even a doctor or two who will remember these. So these are calipers with an orthopedic boot and T-strap, leather T-strap to hold it in place. The thing with this, and I learned this was my student time, is that you didn't order these until about 3 months after people have had their stroke, because it was a major undertaking to fit individuals with their own boot. But of course, it weighed a ton. If you've already got weakness on one side, to then start lifting a caliper with a big boot on was another added disability. So this was before the days, of course, with the plastic orthoses, which have made life so much easier, where you can fit them the same week. So that's Marjorie Warren in action. So she advocated for geriatric medicine to be recognized as a specialty, which it wasn't. As a medical student, we had no Department of Geriatric Medicine. I did my training when I went up to Manchester, where there was the first prof of geriatric medicine in Manchester. And that was my enlightenment. It was amazing. But there was no specialty. And she wanted it to be included in medicine and nursing training. They must be sited on general base hospital wards and siting so that older people could have exactly the same assessment, treatment, investigations, and access to other specialties that the rest of us, well, no, I'm one of them now, but I mean, as younger patients expect. But these people were denied it. So she also advocated for multidisciplinary assessment with an attitude of optimism and hope. So those are her words. You know, if you worked there, it was optimism and hope you came in with, not an attitude, you're never going to get out of here again. So all patients were got out of bed every day as able, dressed in their own clothes. You're not a patient anymore, you're a person, as I think I've said many a time. So really to bring back the personhood and remember that you've got a life out there and people out there who really want you to get better and return home. You are not forgotten. And mobility and independence encouraged. And you only went off to a rest home after comprehensive assessment and a trial of rehabilitation and treatment. And she also developed services in the community. I understand that for the unmarried mothers, she went out into the community and said to people, you've got to look after these people. That's bad for them to be in hospital. They need a home and support in the community, and she did that as well. So she was a social worker. So what are we talking about with? It's geriatric medicine, a branch of general medicine, so we are all general trained as specialists, and then we go off and do geriatric medicine. So the clinical, preventative, remedial, and social aspects of healthcare in older people. And of this, a comprehensive assessment by the whole team, which I've put who the team are, it's the keystone of the service delivery. It is not a case of one person knows what to do. It's my opinion, this is what's going to happen. It's a collective assessment of people and collectively what do we think is the best thing. And obviously it involves negotiation or discussion with whānau, who also have their ideas. What's the place where people, what's their housing arrangements? Have they got stairs to climb? Do they need ramps, rails, etc.? So it involves all of that rather than a diagnosis and prescribed approach. So the health service came about 1948 with Aniram Bevan, and it was obviously a major issue, but what happened was that all the workhouses had to become hospitals. They had to provide infirmaries, trained staff, nursing staff as part of it. So there was no second tier of your second-rate patients and people without resources. We were all in it together. The other thing is that so remember that Marjorie Warren went to the London School of Medicine for Women. In 1948, all the medical schools had to become co-ed. And that's why I went to the free, because it was the only or the main place in which women could be trained as doctors at the free. This William Marsden was fantastic. He was like Marjorie Warren, one in umpteen million. He set up a free service initially. An infirmary, which was entirely free. At that time in London, if you wanted treatment, you either paid for it yourself with your own resources, or you had to have a sponsor. So if you went into hospital, you had to have a sponsor who would guarantee the payment of your bill. So he was incredible because he got together with a whole bunch of mates in a coffee house or tea house and said, we need to change this. So he established a free service here, which then became the London Free Hospital, and Queen Victoria named it the Royal Free Hospital. And then women who had no place to do their clinical training asked the Royal Free, would you take us in? And they did, of course, because that's their whole philosophy. So 1948 became the Royal Free Hospital, School of Medicine, and they took men and women. So William Marsden also founded, sadly his wife died in 1926, I think it was, of cancer. So he again got together with his friends who put their money in, and they created the Marsden Hospital, Cancer Treatment Hospital in London. So which is world renowned. So this man set up both these hospitals, a major contribution. So that's where it was when I turned up for my interview, London School of Hospital for Women, and that was a surprise for me. And the women, of course, are unlike me, who just spent my time playing sport as a teenager. These women had their heads down and they came top of every class. They were amazing. So the rest of us had to learn to follow suit if we were going to keep up.
Florence Nightingale spent some time there too. Florence Nightingale.
Yes, yes. Sorry, Pauline's another Royal Free graduate. So that's why she's sitting here proud. So where did my career go and why are we heading towards Awapuni Hospital? So I went to Bury, which is close to where I was born, and my family, most of my family worked in the cotton mills of Lancashire, north of Manchester. And so 1971, this is a workhouse. And so that was my beginning. It didn't sort of register with me, but there it was, a workhouse. I then moved on to Withington Hospital, again, which was a union workhouse. And this is where I learned my skills and was introduced to geriatric medicine. Here's another one. This is north of Manchester. Started off as Crumpsall Workhouse. It didn't look like that when I was there. This is what it looked like. So 1973 to 74. I then came here, and then I went back again, deciding to do specialist training, which generally geriatricians in New Zealand all had done their training in Britain and then came back. I was coming back, but so I went to Bristol and Manor Park Hospital. So I was there from 79 to 81 and to other hospitals. It's interesting that, so this started off as a prison. So I came here in 82, and it was interesting. I saw this paper, a few years after I arrived, but this was one of my colleagues in Manchester who became the prof of geriatric medicine in Liverpool. But he wrote here, geriatric medicine suffers from a poor image seen by colleagues and health administrators, a second-rate specialty looking for third-rate patients in fourth-rate facilities. Now, that would get you goat, wouldn't it? So that's when I came in 82 and was faced with a very static group of patients here, Palmerston North and Levin. What did the service look like? Well, there was no local knowledge of geriatric medicine. Nobody appreciated the lost opportunity of working with these patients and encouraging their independence and mobility. The Ministry of Health had said to all hospital boards, appoint a geriatrician in 1973, and I was it in 82. So there'd been a lag. When Marjorie Warren wrote her papers of how she did it in 1940s to 60, nobody wrote anything until 1960 and 1970 to say, we've done it and it works. It seems incredible, those lost 20 years where the message wasn't getting out. This is, you know, do something. It's preventable. So the service here primarily worked as a takeaway service for so-called bed blockers. They wanted other patients in. I know it's tough language, but it's the reality. So there were 60 patients waiting, which is enough for two wards, and they were waiting in acute hospital beds, waiting for a takeaway service. Now, the board planned for an increased need. They had our Akautere Hospital planned, and they also, of course, knew the baby boomers were coming, and they sort of, God, you know, how are we going to cope? We must build more hospital beds. So the patients, their whānau, the staff lacked any expectations, just like those people in the workhouses. These people were going nowhere. And also with it, there were perverse incentives. The incentives, if people went to rest homes, they were asset and income tested. So it cost them. People who stayed in hospital care, they were income tested only, so their assets were free of assessment. So it was essentially, for many people, it was free. So the incentives to get up and going were not there unless somebody gave them the opportunity and said, look, life can be a lot better for you. So that they were stuck in limbo, not knowing there was another way. So these were the baby boomers that we all knew were coming, because once they're born, that's it. We knew they were coming. And the 80-year-olds are up here. So it was, they saw it as a crisis. So this was the situation when I came. There were 60 people. I arrived on the ward, there was a big board up and they had 60 names on. And I said, who are these? And they said, this is our waiting list. And I said, how long has the person at the top of the waiting list been waiting? 1 year. So you can imagine as that one person comes down, they'd been incarcerated in the hospital, not having physio, OT, enough nursing to get by. How do you manage somebody who's been lying in bed or sitting beside the bed for a whole year and then said, right, this is our raw material, let's do something. So the waiting time, 12 months, Horafenua, waiting time 12 months, and I looked at the average length of stay, 6 years. So once you were in, you weren't going anywhere. And there were 10 admissions a year to Horafenua Hospital the year I started. Awapuni Hospital, I did a survey the following year, so 84% had been in more than 12 months. So it was a very similar situation for them here. So having seen the state of play, there was only one thing I could do, even though I was a new boy on the block. I sent a report to Tony Poynter, who was the medical super-in-chief, and I said, the Akautere development you're planning is a modern asylum. So, I mean, many people thought I was a lunatic and out of touch. How on earth could I make this assessment of this new building for elderly people, psychiatric patients, etc.? So I did give them a lot of evidence as to why it was true that we need to establish on base hospital site. But they needed a lot of convincing. And I had two professors in Britain who reviewed it. They said, this is the right way to go. John Campbell, who was professor in Dunedin, the only professor of geriatric medicine then, he actually came up and he said, you're very lucky to make a change now. This is the direction. This is not off beam of to left field. This is the right way to do it. So they've decided to form a think tank, and in November, didn't take them long, and there were hospital board members on it, and I had, fortunately, some real assets on the board who were allies. Tony Poynter was one, Nankin Ross, professor of nursing, was the second, and Don Urquhart, who was a radiotherapist, a third. Those people were right behind me. Once they had the information, they were there. But incredibly, despite all of that, the development group said, we advise the board not to go ahead. We're satisfied with the information we've got. But it was still 8-6 to carry it. So it was pretty close. So in 85, they said, right, we'll abandon the development. We'll close our Awapuni Hospital, which was an earthquake risk anyway. And we support the comprehensive service here on base hospital site. So that was major. This is what happened. So I didn't let the grass grow under me while that committee got going. I had a free hand in Levin because they didn't know what was up. Joan Chettleborough was the principal nurse there, and she was fantastic. She said, now I know, I'm a believer, let's do it. So we didn't tell anybody, we just did it. And we went from 10 admissions a year, the year that I arrived, and here we are, nearly 300, 293. That was in 1 year. This is not, I mean, we've got all the resources we need, but we need a direction and a vision. So that's what happened. Here we are, 88, 89, 614. So we had already started this, so by the time we went to the board saying we need to get our service on base hospital site, we already had this proof that it worked. So that was really helpful. So this is what happened to the admissions. So there we are, 82, 83, and what was described as a revolution, at the hospital board's document said, this is a revolution in Levin. We want it now in Palmy. So this is what happens when you get everybody focused in one direction and you work together. So Horofenua, when we had a waiting list, remember, of 12 months. In less than 2 years, we had no waiting list. And the waiting time was 2 days. So if somebody was referred from Palmerston saying they live in the Horofenua area, will you take them? We took them within 2 days. Palmy, because we had to wait for the bureaucratic wheels to turn, and we only got permission in 85, it took till 88 to create a no waiting list service. So what happened at Awapuni Hospital? And so in 83, there were 126 beds. Cleveley Hospital opened in Fielding, and they immediately took 30 patients. And gradually, over the next 5 years, patients were transferred to new wards in Palmy, Cleveley Hospital, Mercy Hospital, and residential care, aged residential care. So that by towards the end of 89, there were 38 beds occupied, and then the hospital closed in December with demolition and the handing over to the Rangitane Marae. And as you heard, I gather a year ago, or maybe the way the Marae Trust has taken that on and providing general practice, but also supporting care services, enveloping the whānau. The window, chapel window, funded by the Ladies' Hospital Auxiliary, is now in the chapel in the main hospital, and that was moved in 1989. So this is where we are now, recognising the custodians of the land on which we are. So that's my story, and I hope you have found some of it's enlightening, but certainly inspiring. You know, it requires inspiration that when you see, when you have a vision and you know the vision can work, here's a path, it would have been irresponsible not to go down that path and to fight for the opportunity. Thank you. that's right. I've said to people, we are fighting for our own the services in our own old age. Yeah. Anyway, I do thank you for coming, and I'm happy if people have got comments or questions they want to make. Hello. Yes, I mean, the papers that Marjorie Warren wrote are all readily available. I've been trying to get people, the new registrars coming along, because really the history of how development occurred has been very important to me. I've collected the papers, and each registrar, advanced training registrar, said, do you want to know why we're in this position? I've had nobody who's wanted the information. Ah, right, well, there you go. So it is all readily available. If you go onto Google Scholar, you'll get all of Marjorie Warren's papers there. No, I mean, amazing woman, and with such an overwhelming workload, but she persuaded the nurses to go with her, and then she got other disciplines to come along. So it's a case of inspiring people in the beginning. Believe in me, let's go down this path. But now we know what the path is. It's easy enough now to put in anywhere.
Weren't we lucky to have someone with such vision? You can just feel the passion, can't you? I could, and I think it's just amazing. So it puts a whole different perspective on what we had down the road. And I think we're very fortunate to have... you join us in our community. You played such a large part. That's just amazing. So thank you. So there is afternoon tea, and I'm sure there'll be an opportunity for you to talk with Fred about aspects that you might want to recollect or comment on. So thank you all very much for coming. I thought... Bev...
You're listening to Manawatū People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū, and you've just been listening to our recording of the talk, A History of Awapuni Hospital, given by Dr. Fred Hurst at Boho Cafe in Awapuni on Wednesday the 13th of March. If you'd like to hear this again or share it with a friend, you can find the on-demand version on our website if you go to www.npr.nz/show/specials.